Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Tosin Unafawakin.
And I'm Chris Bernor.
Christopher Bernor, it's great to have you back. It feels like we get you few and far between in between all of your busy tech startup work.
Yeah, it's great to be back. I sort of particularly wanted to be on this week and next week, and it turns out Dwayne was traveling, so glad to join you. I always keep thinking that just around the corner, somehow I will be less busy, and just around the corner, it seems to become more.
Well, I mean, that's a good thing, though. You want that as a startup. You want to be busier and
busier. That's true, yes. It's better than being bored and wondering what to do and sort of lost. That would certainly be a negative. I don't think that would go over well with the investors or the customers.
Right. I mean, we want it to be the case where you have to schedule, put it on your busy schedule. Okay, I need to take a little break so I can do the Drill Down podcast. You know, have your secretary put it on the calendar.
Siri? I'll tell Siri. Get right on it.
So this week at WWDC, Apple rolls out new updates for MacBooks, OS 10, iOS 7, and a new Mac Pro. Also at E3, we find out more about the Xbox One, the PS4, and all the great games you'll be playing on them. Plus, Google buys Waze. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to Geeks of Doom, and our link for the podcast is in the right-hand sidebar. And, of course, you can subscribe to us on Facebook and Twitter as well, both on The Drill Down. Just a note here before we start the show. Last week, a whistleblower working for the CIA disclosed documents showing that the National Security Agency is secretly eavesdropping on the phone and data communications of millions of American citizens. This is one of the most significant leaks in U.S. political history, and trust me, we at The Drill Down are more than anxious to discuss it. Unfortunately, due to scheduling conflicts, we're unable to have our full contingent to talk about it this week, plus the fact that the story is still developing. And the whistleblower is still leaking new documents on an almost daily basis. Next week, we're going to have a full panel, including Greg Davies from the Blendover and Disquisition podcast to help out. So be sure to tune into that. In the meantime, let's get into some of the headlines of this week's episode. So sources report that Google Inc. will acquire Waze for $1.3 billion. We hinted a little bit about this last week or the week before, where we talked about Facebook and Google being in a bidding war over Waze, and then Facebook pulled out. We weren't sure what was going to happen with Waze after that. According to some reports, the deal fell through because Waze insisted that its employees should continue working in Israel, which Facebook didn't accept that term. Google has already made two acquisitions in Israel, and it has an office there, in contrast to Facebook, which closed most of the companies it's acquired, including Israeli startups. So Google's basically said, you know what, you guys work wherever you want, and we'll work with you. We'll pretty much be hands-off of Waze. I think that's a great idea. I mean, Google Maps is already a pretty powerful app as it is, but I can't imagine with the folding in of Waze services, the social services, and the socially powered information that Waze users bring to freeway events is just going to make it that much more phenomenal. I'm wondering if they're going to fold it in.
Do you think?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think that they're purchasing it because of the social features, or are they purchasing it so that Apple and Facebook don't get it?
Well, it's certainly a good strategic move. Plus the fact that they stated that they're going to leave it alone. So it doesn't sound like they're, at least not immediately, aren't going to fold it into Google Maps. But I mean, why would you? It would be a shame to buy Waze and not leverage the power of their, you know, those advantages into your own system.
I think at this point, at least according to all the news, it seemed like Apple was completely out and Facebook had taken a huge backstep because the ways individuals didn't want to move. So I really don't think it was that much of a political move. You know, if it really was one, Google would make fun of how much they spent for Waze. Some little tech joke there.
They would throw it in there. Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I guess I used Waze a little bit. And back when there was the whole Maps fiasco and I was basically looking for a Maps solution that was okay. But I don't know. I just wasn't that blown away by it when I used it. It just seemed like, I don't know. I just didn't care for it that much. I find it hard to believe spending 1.3, you know, for it. I don't get it.
Waze, for me, Waze, like, came into the forefront of my, like, it rose to the top of my navigation usage in that brief period of time when Apple released their own maps and it was pretty much a failure, and before Google Maps had come on to the iOS market. So there was that brief moment of time when there was no real alternative, and Waze was my alternative, and I was using it on a daily basis until Google Maps released their own version. So I did like it for what it was. I like the fact that basically the freeway status is updated almost instantaneously by other Waze users.
Yeah, if Google can sort of use their leverage to like get more people to sign up for it, then it seems like it was one of those things where it could be very useful if they had enough people on it. But I think when I tried them out, there just was not enough people. Like I would see like one person up in like the city who was on it, and I'm like, well, that's not telling me anything about the traffic where I am.
All right, let's move on here. Now, Chris, you brought this next article to our attention.
This is just a funny article. Like this is the Register I got this from, so it might be a little bit embellished. But apparently, so Facebook opened a new data center, up in Oregon. I think Previne, Oregon is where it is. Mm-hmm. I couldn't remember the name of the city. But I think I hear that it's their first like full data center with they are running the entire thing. Which is kind of impressive given how big they are. They've been able to sort of run it out of rented data centers. Wow. However, it has a sort of unique cooling system. And apparently this caused, as Facebook called it, a humidity event, which in sort of more layman's terms meant that there was a cloud inside the data center that powered the cloud raining on the cloud, which apparently led to servers shorting out and power supplies, you know, failing and general mayhem, which I'm sure was extremely pain for those who had to run the data center. But just sort of looking at the hubris of the cloud, we sort of never thought about hubris on sort of that literal of a level.
I'm surprised that they didn't forecast this, you know, they're 5 days in ahead and have the appropriate people. See, running a cloud is not easy work. You know what's actually really interesting? So from my experience, Box, I've been in we have our own data centers, which we own, and I've been in there, gotten tours, as well as seen lots of other interesting things in there. But one of the what's really cool about our data centers is we have we're very precise about it, and there's a lot of precision from the top down in terms of its design and how it aesthetically seems and looks. So it's kind of also, to a certain extent, designed to be a cloud in terms of, you know, wires, colors, everything. It's actually really impressive to see. If you ever get a special chance to tour our data centers, definitely check it out. But, you know, a lot of places do lots of unique things like that. And, there are always very unique data center stories that you hear all the time. Anytime there's major events that take down data centers or take down, you know, I bet you there are some pretty crazy stories from, I think it was DC or Virginia when the pipe was, that took down, you know, Netflix and a bunch of other big services were stopped. Between people were driving, you know, 90 miles on the highway to get to the data centers to try and resolve things. Pretty interesting lifestyle, but also pretty difficult.
Yeah, it's good to remember that there are the women and men who literally keep the physical. I mean, we always think of the internet as out there sort of somewhere, but you know, there are physical boxes that run the thing we call the internet.
Yeah, I rarely ever think about the actual physical issues involved in data storage on a massive scale like that, but it's interesting that there are situations that most people can't even comprehend because they just don't occur on that. They don't deal with data on that scale, on that massive scale. All right, so let's get into the major topics of tonight's discussion, WWDC and E3. We'll start with WWDC. So every year at this time, Apple leads the keynote at its Worldwide Developers Conference, and that has famously been when former CEO Steve Jobs would unveil the secret of company's latest tech innovations. Past WWDC keynotes introduce the Apple's iApps line, the Mac Pro, the iPhone 4, iOS, Time Machine Bootcamp, the App Store, Mobile Me, and FaceTime. However, the last couple of WWDC keynotes have been seen as tepid and uneventful by Apple critics, and it was suggested that perhaps Apple was no longer capable of innovating since Steve Jobs' passing. Now, I don't know how you guys feel about this year's WWDC, but I feel like this year, Tim Cook and company reached the heights of anything under Steve Jobs' rule. Let's just go over some of the things that they talked about. We'll take it one by one. Let's talk about their announcement of the new iteration of the OS X operating system. So they unveiled Mavericks, the start of the next 10 years of their OS X operating system, with a naming switch from Breeds of Cat to California Locales, this one being a popular surf spot in Northern California, which, by the way, happens to be named after a dog.
This actually goes...
Seals?
Seals?
Didn't they used to do this back the day?
Sea lion? Did you catch...
was that a brief one for a moment? Brief sea lion? They should have gone sea lion. I do seem to remember, like, back in the day, early before the cats, that they had, like, Redwood or something like that. They were doing...
Yeah, I seem to remember. All I can remember is Copeland, which is obviously not a place, but...
Might have been with a 9, with the OS 9, right?
Yeah. I'm just glad that they're not doing the cats anymore, because honestly, it was getting, like, impossible to remember, like, which cat came in which order. Because, you know, one of the nice things about Android is that the naming convention actually tells you quite a bit while still being fun and easy to know, you know? Whereas, you know, with cats, I couldn't... Mountain lion, lynx, house cat.
With Android, isn't it all desserts? Like,
but they're in alphabetical order.
Ah, I never put two and two together. I know with Ubuntu...
Oh, yeah.
I know Ubuntu has been... alphabetical with the animals.
Yeah, so Ubuntu is alphabetical, and so is Android.
I didn't
Makes
know that.
Makes it very easy to
use. Yeah, but OS X is all over the place.
Eclair.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So, at least now we know. I don't actually remember a great deal about... I mean, it looked like they had some nice improvements to it. Multi-display support is actually... pretty nice.
Multiple
especially given the amount of computing
support?
Horsepower.
So that means that that users will be able to access the menu bar and dock separately on each display. Also, that they're folding in support for Apple TV, so you can use your Apple TV as a full powered display as well.
Oh, that's really cool. When are they going to do something with Apple TV? Like, they are just selling tons and tons and tons of these devices that don't seem to do much, and yet, I don't know, I just have this feeling that they have some evil or genius plan around Apple TV. Like, they're going to, like, release some sort of software update and be like, ha-ha! Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, they have been talking about the whole television thing, how that was Steve Jobs' dying words, is that, you know, that they've got something planned for television that is going to change the way we watch TV, and since then we hadn't really heard too much, but I think they're still committed to Apple TV, if even in a sort of nominal, you know, on life support sort of way.
Yeah.
Also, some of the other features in OS X are App Now, which reduces power usage on tasks hidden in the background. Also, support for maps. Users will be able to search for directions on their Mac and send that route to their iPhone for use in their vehicle. The iBooks platform is now going to be on OS X as well, including the iBook Store for purchasing new content, and iCloud Keychain for cross-platform support for securely syncing and saving passwords and login information, performing like the same sort of function as like a one password app.
Mm-hmm. One password is Mac only, right?
I don't know if it is, but I use it on my Mac. I don't know if it's available on the PC.
Well, or other platforms.
Or any other platform.
Yeah. But, it looks like it is on Windows. It's only real operating systems that apparently it doesn't support.
Yeah. No, what's that?
Sorry, that was unnecessarily mean.
The other cool thing which I think they added was the ability to do tagging as well as maps.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
That's really cool. I've been thinking about that idea for years now, that like half the time I don't really want to put my files in like separate specific folders. Well, I mean, if I'm doing like coding, obviously I do. But for my documents, my images and whatever, like I just want a database with like a bunch of attributes that I can just look up based on those attributes, you know?
Didn't the whole tagging thing, didn't that sort of originate as part of the other, there was another operating system, was it ZFS, another file system? Was it ZFS I'm thinking of, where
that allows us.
What's that?
Oh, let me look up CFS. No, I got a file system with tagging.
Yeah, yeah. I seem to remember that for a while there, both Mac and Microsoft were developing the ZFS file system, and that had this sort of dynamic tagging system as well. And Windows abandoned it because it was just they couldn't get it to work with legacy Windows, and Macs had always intended to fold it into OS X eventually.
Well, there was Win Future Storage, WinFS, also DHTFS. I don't think none of these look terribly like they got off the ground. TagFS? I don't know.
I seem to remember. I'll do some more research on that, and we can talk about that later. But yeah, no, I think I love the whole tag things, and the fact that you can tag, that you can just drag and drop stuff into a tagged bin, and it will automatically tag those items as well.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's gonna really help with the organization of your files. Yeah,
it seems they also pushed a lot of improvements to Safari too, in terms of you know, reading lists, links, the ability to send your maps information for directions to also your mobile devices and other things coming from your Apple PC or from your you know, Apple machine that you've had for Google Maps for all ages. Little things like that.
They also updated their MacBook Air line. The latest MacBook Airs don't change the equation, but they finesse the product a little bit further with fourth generation Haswell Intel processors and 802.11 AC Wi-Fi. The base price of the Air is still $999, making it the cheapest MacBook in town. But with that price, you get 128 gigabytes of SSD storage as opposed to 64 gigs of last year. The step-up 1199 model doubles that storage to 256 gigs. Upgrading to 512 gigs costs less than last year, too. You get 11-inch 512 gig Air for $1,499. That's a pretty good price. Cosmetically, it's identical to last year's version. A 9 and 12 hour battery life is on the new Airs is a big step up from the 5 and 7 hour battery results of last year's model. So that's their big sort of their big promotion for this year is that it's all day battery life on these MacBook Airs. Which honestly, you know, I haven't been too disappointed with the performance of my MacBook Air as it is. I don't necessarily need it to be 12 hours all on, but it's nice when they can do it. I think that they haven't actually added too much. They did tear down of these MacBook Airs already on one of the sites. The site, I think it's iFixit.com, the site that does all the teardowns, and they noted that there really wasn't much in addition to the existing batteries from the previous MacBook Air, so the energy savings are all due to the Haswell processors
and just efficiency and everything.
Yeah.
That's, you know, this is one thing where I wish Apple had more. I mean, I guess they have reputation, but more like kudos. I mean, they are head and shoulders above anybody else when it comes to battery life. I mean, 12-hour battery life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm, you know, surprised when, you know, my old PC would get, you know, 3, you know, like just not even in the same ballpark.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just comparing like the advertised battery life, let alone the actual battery life you see. And then the same thing with the iPhone. Like, there was some tweet I saw the other day about how like Android users don't use their phones quite as much as iPhone users. And having owned an Android phone, I will tell you why we don't use our phones as much. It's because if you use it even a little bit throughout the day, it is dead at the end, utterly dead. And I kind of need it, you know, to be able to get home everything.
Yeah. Did you ever remember those days when you would get a laptop and if you wanted extra battery life, you'd have to get one of those outboard battery, you know?
Oh yeah.
And they'd be big and chunky and like way down the laptop.
Sort of turn your laptop into
turn your portable into not portable anymore.
I'm going to buy a really light. Yeah, exactly. Ceases to be portable. Sort of defeats the whole purpose. Might as well just walk around with like a universal power supply.
Right. Okay, so this next announcement at WWDC, I was personally ecstatic, over the moon about, especially being a film editor by profession. So Apple teased a revamp of its desktop Mac Pro. According to Phil Schiller, it's for users who want only the, quote, fastest, most expensive Mac in existence. It sports a striking new cylindrical design and a remarkable power boost. And it's 1/8 the size of the current Mac Pro. It's built around a unified thermal core, allowing it to share its thermal capacity more efficiently with all the processors. It's got super fast ECC memory and 60 gigs per second of bandwidth, which is near twice as much as the previous model. It's also 2.5 times faster than the previous Mac Pro, delivering 7 teraflops of computing power and a new PCIe-based flash storage, which is 10 times faster than conventional desktop hard drives. Finally, it's the first Mac to come standard with dual workstation GPUs, giving it a faster, more powerful graphical performance with the ability to support up to 3 4K displays simultaneously. It's got 6 Thunderbolt 2 ports, as well as 4 USB ports, gigabit Ethernet, and HDMI out. It's backwards compatible with Thunderbolt 1 and FireWire, which means you can connect a ton of external storage and displays to it easily and transfer information between Macs faster than ever before. And it looks sexy as hell, if I don't mind saying so. I mean, it was just drool worthy, and I just know that it's going to be super expensive.
That's a really
odd design. Like you ever seen the Cray One?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The big sort of cylindrical. The Crays were so big and sort of unwieldy that they turned them into, they made them dual services couches. Like you could sit around the center pilaster of those Crays.
Yeah. Yes.
But you're right, Tosin. Yeah. It's a weird design for it. You know what it kind of reminds me a little bit of, in a way, is remember the Cube, the Mac Cube? What was it? I don't think it was pre G3 even. It was that Johnny Ive designed cube that was in that Lucite sort of housing. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, it had huge problems.
Was it like a Power Mac?
Yeah, it was like a Power Mac cube, and the problem was that it would get so hot that it would crack the Lucite housing around it. The air wouldn't flow through as well. With this one, I think they've solved that problem because the air goes in through the top and then out through the bottom like a turbine.
I think that the design of this is brilliant. It's one of those cases where like the form and the function like come together synergistically in this awesome like concept. So like the whole thing being built around the thermal core, it almost reminds me of like the design of like cooling towers and nuclear power plants, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, where like the heat from all of the parts on the side is going to go into the center, and all that is going to go raise up through the center with this sort of thermal core, which of course has a fan, is going to blow it up too. So you're essentially combining the natural heat flow with, you know, some extra boost to keep it cool, which is probably why they're able to get just, I mean, the thing is a beast and it looks like a toy. It's just, I think it's a reminder that Apple is just one of the best hardware manufacturers out there. There's just nothing else like that.
Yeah, this reminded me a lot of Star Wars, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. Actually, although it doesn't look similar in form to the little robot that was going through the halls at the time that Han and Luke had Chewie in handcuffs, leaving the reactor, but it's that sort of futuristic aesthetic to it, you know, this out of the world design.
Yeah, no, absolutely, I agree. It's one of those things. I'm wondering how noisy it's going to be, because I have to imagine that it's going to be pushing a lot of air through its center core, unless it's got such a big fan that it does it, you know, fairly quietly. Plus, I admire how they've managed to save all that space and making it an eighth of the size of the current Mac Pro line. They're just masters at using things efficiently. Okay, so let's get down to iOS 7. That was like sort of the big announcement of the evening. So Apple officially took the wraps off of iOS 7. According to Tim Cook, it's the biggest change of the platform since the iPhone was introduced 5 years ago. The new design is evident in everything from sharper, flatter icons, slimmer fonts, a new slide to unlock function and a new control panel that slides up from the bottom of the screen for frequently accessed settings. The stock apps have all been redesigned, including a major revamp of the weather app with new animations that are scarily reminiscent of Yahoo's great looking weather app graphics, which we've which you introduced me to a couple of weeks ago there, Tosin. Apple's head of design, Johnny Ive, notes that the new icons feature a new palette of colors. Gone are the bold primary colors of old, replaced by modern shades and tones. Flat design is very prominent in iOS 7. Everything from the buttons to the switches to the Chrome surrounding apps have been modernized and flattened. Apple says the new design makes your phone, quote, appear bigger because each app makes better use of the screen real estate available to it. The calendar, phone, messages, game center, all others have lost their skeuomorphic designs and now feature clean, flat layouts. The signal bars in the upper left corner of the phone have been replaced with a series of dots. Folders can now support hundreds of apps. The 12 to 16 app limit is a thing of the past. That is actually, that I'm very grateful about that. I cannot wait to stuff my folders with more apps.
That was getting so annoying with all those, you know, one-off apps or the right. ones that you had, you know, you got a replacement. Like, you know, I'm the sort of person, I download a replacement for almost all of the built-in ones. And I'm just I want to just put all the built-in ones somewhere, you know, together.
Right.
And that's like, they don't fit in one folder. I have two built-in apps and it just gets annoying.
I was having like casual game folder one, casual game folder two.
Yeah, exactly.
Not anymore.
So have you got a chance to play with it or see it at all? Or
Tosin has.
Yeah, I actually was playing with it today. One of my colleagues had it installed. Yourself, Chris, did you get a chance? Or
Yeah. My our designer at work has a friend who is a developer, and he installed it on his phone, has been using it all week. He really likes it. Now, if you go on GroupTie's site, you'll see it kind of matches our style. So he definitely has a predisposition to like that style. But I don't know. I've found that, especially looking at the direction that Android and Windows Phone have gone, it just looks sort of out of date to have all the gloss and the shiny and the little, you know, patterns and, you know, fake metal and fake fabric everywhere. And it looked just so almost like jarring compared to the sort of sleekness and minimalism of the, you know, the phone itself. And then you open it up and there's like little pieces of paper tearing off the Notes app. I don't know. I'm a big fan. I know it's going to be rough. I know it's not going to be perfect. I know people are going to get turned off. I've seen rants, as you always get whenever Apple does something. People love to hate Apple. They hate Apple as they love it. But I don't know. I'm glad to see it. I'm excited for what Johnny is going to get through here.
It's a really welcome change here that they've been able to at least adapt something that's been existing for many, many years. You know, basically since I've been in college, we've had the same basic aesthetic. So it's very good to see that something refreshing is out. Now, of course, this is going to be polarizing, as many of Apple's, you know, recent decisions are. But from playing around with it, and I was using it on a colleague's 4S, it's definitely the background thing is noticeable. It's kind of unique, that sort of 3D architecture. It's kind of, it seems currently as a fun toy, but who knows how others may utilize it. But it seemed pretty snazzy, pretty sleek. Having the way which I'd actually kind of describe it is essentially, for a lot of the apps, they took a lot of the better capabilities of apps that had already evolved in the iOS marketplace and added them to their default architecture. So, for example, you know, in some regards, the Mail app does remind you of pieces of Mailbox or other types of applications. The Weather app is almost spot on with the Yahoo Weather, which is where they get their data from as well, too. It doesn't have as much information, but it's more concise. And it was more refreshing when I was trying to like take a photo. I could easily slide between if I was recording, if I was you know, taking it in landscape, in a panoramic format, and just the usability has increased. Now, what's also really interesting is so has the minimalistic approach, especially when you're looking at the icons in terms of, you know, does this give me multiple views, multiple pages, how I rotate things around. But I thought as far as using it on a 4S, it felt pretty good. I'd be more curious to see it on, you know, a 5, something more snappy, to see, you know, what sort of speed improvements I noticed. And then I think the final thing is there's also a bit of compression with the new font style. When I was looking at I was actually, for the entire test, I had my 5 next to this 4S, and I was comparing the various menus, various options to see, you know, what had adjusted. And I noticed that the address catalog, you know, not only with the different font, was shrunk at the side in terms of the hitting the various letters to jump to the different sections. But yeah, overall, I think it's a good step in the right direction. I think there's a lot of cool, unique features that will be fun to play around with, and I think it's only going to get better as we go forward. So it's good to see Apple take a foray into something new and unique.
Yeah, I think it's honestly, I think this almost is the beginning of, although I won't say the completion of, the answer to the criticism of, can Apple stay Apple, you know, without Steve? And I think part of the answer to that is to realize that, you know, I mean, Steve was a huge, 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 you know, plus for Apple. But in some ways, he was somewhat of a chain around Apple, too. One reason apparently why it would take so long for them to get stuff out is that almost every single thing, like screen, interface, dialogue box, whatever, had to be, like, personally approved by Steve. And, like, I could vouch for that. At least one of my coworkers used to work at Apple and was writing some marketing material sites and pushed it out and basically had an email directly from Steve being like, this sucks, take it down. Like, and she was writing, you know, minor marketing sites. That happens. And there's one reason why, you know, a lot of stuff just hadn't been updated, because, you know, once you have it, once Steve likes it, don't change it. And I think allowing, you know, the really creative and talented people at Apple to sort of take on their own identity and, you know, move Apple forward with what they want it to be is the only way that they're going to be able to survive. And it looks like that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I mean, I think that this is to me, this WWDC really felt like Tim Cook's true emergence as his true sort of independence, his breakaway from the shadow, the legacy of Steve Jobs, asserting himself as leading this company into the next the next generation. And I think, yeah, you know, with things like the Mac Pro, which is designed and assembled in the U.S., and the new letting Johnny Ive take the skeuomorphic brakes off of iOS and do whatever he wants to the interface, and coming up with something that is completely his own without any sort of Jobs influence. I think this is where this company needs to go.
I totally agree.
So let me just talk about a couple of the other elements of iOS 7. So we talked about briefly about Control Center, which is that swipe up menu that gives you access to, lets you toggle airplane mode, control your music, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, flashlight, finally, brightness, finally, and multitasking. It's support for all apps on multitasking, not just limited services or stock apps. The new features let the apps update in the background without affecting battery life, and has smart features to update certain apps during certain times of day when you have stronger wireless coverage. Safari has been improved, featuring full screen browsing, gesture-based navigation, and a new flipping card tab overview that's very similar in the to the interface in Google's Chrome for iOS and Android. AirDrop is a new feature in iOS 7 that lets you share content with other iOS users through the control center. Lets you share with other users who are close by and tells you who you can send content to right within control center. It's basically like Bump, that app Bump for the iOS is, except without bumping somebody's phone. It basically lets you send information that you want to via its own protocol.
Which is nice, because one of the big problems with Bump is just getting finding people who have Bump.
Right.
Like,
right.
I've honestly never found someone who had Bump that I could share stuff with. Or if I did, I didn't have any reason to share anything with mm-hmm. them. But, you know, even at tech events in Silicon Valley, I've asked people, do you have Bump? No, nobody has Bump.
Which is, you know, mystifies me, because it seems to me like the most convenient way to share contact information, instead of like having someone call you and then adding that to the thing, just send the V card. I mean, I don't know why it has to be so difficult.
This seems like it's Apple's way of dealing with NFC rather than actually implementing NFC. Now we'll see if that potentially changes with the next iPhone, but right. It's a unique mechanism in which they can have people share content with friends and people who you don't know as well too. So we'll see what direction it takes, but it could be pretty cool.
It feels to me like the most right now the most compelling reason to have NFC on a phone is for payment services, like wallet services. The Google phones have it, and Apple doesn't, but I don't know what the use case is. You know, if people are actually using NFC on their Android phones, what those metrics are, how people are using it on there, if they're using it at all, or if they don't even aren't even aware that it exists.
So typically, my friends, at least here in the Valley, tend to use it for sharing like map directions. Mm-hmm. So you just toss those over, sharing photos that they've just taken. You know, you take a group photo, hey, I'd like to have a copy of that, sending that over. And also sometimes contact records as well too. But you know, the joke has always been, let's tap our phones to share. Oh, you're using an iPhone, we can't do that.
Also, cameras and camera and photos have been updated with improved UI, square photo framing, and new filters. The Photos app as well. Photos' new Moments feature organizes images by time and location and can provide an overview of all the pictures you've taken in a particular year. It has gesture-based pop-up previews of images that you bring up by sliding your finger across the grid of images. Siri features a predictably flat new interface and has been upgraded with new voices, so you can choose from either a female or male voice in English, French, and German, with more languages added over time. It can now control functions such as toggling Bluetooth or controlling brightness or playing back voicemail messages. Here's another one that I found that I thought was really interesting and hopefully will be more widely adopted. iOS in the car. The functionality has been greatly improved with version 7. It's now possible to have iOS on screen in a number of cars coming in 2014. You can control the system, place calls, play music, look up directions, all with your voice, thanks to the improved Siri integration. The App Store is getting the ability to show you apps that are popular for where you are, such as in a museum, and also features automatic app updates in the background. Oh, and so let's talk about iTunes Radio. So this is one of the biggest upgrades to iOS 7 is the new music player, which features a brand new user interface, and iTunes Radio service, which is the company's answer to streaming music services such as Spotify, RDO, and Google Music All Access. It's basically their version of Pandora. It's going to work on iPhone, iPod Touch, iPad, iTunes, and the Mac and PC. It's provided for free with ads, but iTunes Match subscribers can listen to it ad-free, and it'll be available in the U.S. to start. What did you think about this, iTunes Radio?
Pretty excited to see something moving up in the Pandora space. Although, honestly, I really see Pandora and Spotify and Google sort of... Google needs to work on its branding. I can't even remember what the name of their Spotify thing is, but the Google Spotify thing, as sort of two different things. Like, there's the radio that sort of plays you continuous streaming, sort of semi-randomized, semi-recommended stuff like Pandora does. And then there's this sort of like music locker that allows you to choose what it is you're going to do. And it sounds like this is more just like a radio, right?
Well, it's folded into their music player. So it's going to be a radio that's, you know, you can curate radio stations based on popular songs. You can choose songs to listen to on demand. I think it's a little bit of both, which it feels like that's the way it should be, right? Like you listen to the stuff that you have in your collection, plus you can tune into the radio if you want to. And then I imagine that with the iTunes Match service that there will be some sort of cross functionality where if you hear a song on the radio, you can tap a command or something and then have that song, you know, add that song on to your iTunes, make a purchase, go directly to purchase that song if you like it.
That would be pretty cool. I'm sort of surprised. I mean, obviously Shazam did extremely well with that and sort of really moved that forward, but it doesn't seem like it's that difficult to implement that functionality. Like, I've seen 4 or 5 tutorials online that are like, oh, here, how I implemented Shazam in like a weekend. So I'm sort of surprised that it hasn't sort of come into things like Apple or iTunes. So yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty excited about this. I think I'm most excited about iOS 7. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The other stuff is nice. It'd be cool to see what happens. I just hope that they actually get Siri working. Siri is such a cool idea, but she just needs that much more integration with iOS, with third-party apps. Like, there needs to be an API for Siri that allows, you know, me to make an app that's going to use this functionality. And that's going to help them with their language processing too, because one of the things with language processing, you just need tons of data. And if people consider it to be not useful, then they're just not going to use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I highly agree, because I use Siri quite a lot, and it would be nice to have additional functionality to it. You know, Google's own thing, does Google even have a name for it? They have something, and it performs very well. There's a lot of really unique things that it can do. Now, it performs in practice. I haven't seen it perform as well as Siri, but, you know, that's only from a few use cases. But I would just I rely on Siri on a daily basis, setting records. Wouldn't it be, you know, what I really want is I want a Jarvis, right? I want to be able to wake up in the morning and be like, Siri, what do I have planned for today? Now we have that today feature. Yeah. Imagine if Siri can actually dictate that. I hope that's in there. But that's what I really want. And you know what actually I think excites me the most about this release of iOS 7 is really what they're actually doing on the development side, because it seems as though that they are opening up a bit more of their APIs and allowing people to do more unique things behind the covers, as well as standardizing a few things for developers. So I'm kind of really interested and curious to see what that brings out, because I think we're just at the tip of the mobile lifestyle for everyone, and the tip of the mobile development, to see what sort of unique and creative ideas people can develop over time.
Yeah. Yeah, in general, I'm excited about the whole basically the whole development of iOS 7, and I can't wait to use it. I love the whole thing about it's a stupid little design touch, but I kind of love it. Is the whole parallax sort of view where it looks like each layer of the interface is about 1/8 of an inch away from each other. And so when you move the phone, you know, back and forth, it sort of moves in parallax. What do you think about that? Do you think that's just sort of like...
I think that's awesome. I don't know. It's...
You don't feel like it's needlessly showy?
No, I mean, it's one of those things that it seems like it's subtle, so it's not going to get annoying, but it's a reminder of just sort of how badass your phone is. It also does serve a nice sort of like visual cue to let you know what's background and what's foreground. And I also think it's just like a great sort of response. They can be like, well, no, it's not flat design. It's simply simplified.
Now, you know, there were a lot of fans of what they saw at WWDC, but not everybody was a fan. Joshua Topolsky, writing in Verge, wrote an article essentially criticizing the iOS 7 design functionality. He said that instead of correcting issues, Apple has simply given them a fresh coat of paint and several layers of sub-navigation. He says he's hopeful that in the next few months, Apple ramps up for the introduction of new hardware. Some of the design and functionality issues that have yet to be addressed will be nipped and tucked. And perhaps he criticizes some of the design, like he calls the icons 3D globs rendered together against a white background. Some of the icons look a little bit like clip art, more childish than elegant, a mishmash of, you know, the weather. For example, the weather icon is a mishmash of sun, clouds, and a gradient background that was highlighted as part of their new grid system. It might be on a grid, but it doesn't look very good. I don't know. Do you think there's any sort of relevance to what he's talking about?
I don't know. I just feel like this happens every time Apple changes anything. Like, people complain that they don't change, and then people complain as soon as they do change.
Yeah. Tosin, any?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I think I find this design a bit more polarizing for than other things Apple has done in the past. Like, it's kind of a divergence. Mm-hmm. And I also definitely see that because the palette that they're using is so much brighter. I read an article that a lot of the icons were designed individually by the various teams, and there was kind of like a competition to see who could design, you know, whose design would be taken. So you can see why there may not be as such a convergence. And when I first saw it, I was like, oh, so bright, the palette, you know, it's like a little kid with a crayon going crazy. But
yeah,
you know, in this day and age, why not sign? And I think for every person who hates it, you're also going to have another person who really loves it. So I think until we see the final product and get to play around with it a lot more than we already have, that's where you know, the real test comes in.
Yeah, honestly, looking at the icons in my current application, I can't exactly say that. I mean, they look like a mishmash to me. Photos has a, you know, a photograph on it where and is glossy, whereas like contacts and notes are flat. I mean, you could already argue this problem, and it's always sort of actually been an issue for me about Apple's sort of icons in particular. I've never liked Apple's icons. They don't match size, they don't match style, they don't match. They're all sort of like jumbly different. So actually seeing a common design language, I think, is great. And keep in mind, this is the first version of a new system.
Right.
This is not even what's going to be released in September. Mm-hmm. This is the beta. So I don't know. I think it's easy way to get a bunch of traffic to write an article about how Apple is wrong.
You think it's unusual for Apple to preview something that is still so much in beta?
I don't know. I mean, they've tended to do like about this sort of time period releases. not as big of a change, but then again, they haven't made this big of a change yet. But I don't know. This seems relatively par for the course for them, in my opinion.
Also, any last thoughts on Apple's announcements or WWDC in general before we move on?
September won't come soon enough, so far. Whenever they release this, so that we can actually use it and see what they may have up in terms of new iPhone or other aspects to that.
All right, then. Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter by Tom Bissell. Millions of adults spend hours every week playing video games, and the industry itself now reliably out-earns Hollywood. But the wider culture seems to regard video games as, at best, well-designed if mindless entertainment. Extra Lives is an impassioned defense of this assailed and misunderstood art form. Tom Bissell argues that we are in a golden age of gaming, but he also believes games could be even better. Blending memoir, criticism, and first-rate reportage, Extra Lives is like no other book on the subject. Whether you love video games, loathe video games, or are merely curious about why they're becoming the most dominant popular art form of our time, Extra Lives is required listening. Now that book, or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, can be yours for free. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and a 30-day trial to check out their service. Even if you don't like the service, even if your Audible's not your thing, you get to keep the book for free. Now, this offer is only open to new Audible subscribers only. If you've never subscribed before, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown, and that helps us out here on our show. All right, we're going to take a little break and listen to some music. And when we return, E3 2003, what's new this year and who won the Xbox PlayStation console war? Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Tosin Onufuwakin and Christopher Bernor. So, Microsoft's Xbox One announcement last month left something off the list, video games. E3 was Microsoft's chance to correct that oversight, and did they ever? This week's E3 press conference was a nonstop onslaught of games, games, games for Microsoft. Like every major console in the past decade, the Xbox One will be launched in November. This holiday will be more crowded than last year's solo Wii U launch, as Microsoft will be launching its console directly against the PS4, which presumably won't risk breaking the trend and will arrive in November to raid holiday shopping budgets as well. Near the tail end of their press conference, Microsoft delivered the bad news. The Xbox One will retail for $499 when it ships. That's in comparison to the Xbox 360's $399 launch price back in 2005, which is partially credited for the 360's initial success over the more pricey, at the time, PS3. But to be fair, the Xbox One's inclusion of a tricked-out Kinect sensor in addition to new-generation graphics can provide some justification for the steep introductory price. Microsoft promises hundreds of games will be released for the 360 in the coming years. Amongst some of the other features, smart glass integration, 2 free games a month for Xbox Live Gold members, the ability to stream to Twitch TV, which is you can stream your voice and video of yourself in addition to your gameplay footage, using a UI similar to the Xbox's built-in Skype functionality. Microsoft points are no more. They're moving to real money.
Yay.
Yes, yes. How confusing was that points thing for the longest time?
Such a mess. I'd always have to look up the conversion online.
Right.
It's like another currency.
It is. It was just basically their way about their way of getting around the whole the whole thing of a direct currency exchange. But I'm so glad that that's done with. So let's talk about some of the games that Microsoft announced during their conference, and then we'll talk in general about the Xbox, about our feelings about the Xbox One, our evaluation of it overall in light of their conference. They talked about Halo, a new version of Halo coming in 2014, promises support from cloud computing, dedicated servers, and will take full advantage of the Xbox One to run at smooth 60 frames per second. Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, featuring Kiefer Sutherland as the voice of Snake. Rise, the Son of Rome, which is a new IP, originally announced in 2011 for the Xbox 360. It's now an Xbox One exclusive, built to showcase Crytek's next-gen graphics engine. Kinect Sports Rival. Kinect Sports Rivals, which is, is the successor to the previous generation's Kinect Sports. Forza 5. And by the way, let me say that it seems like the proportion of Kinect dedicated games to non-Kinect games is even smaller this generation than so far, at least, than last year.
What do you mean by proportion is smaller? Like there are fewer of them or more?
Yes,
of them?
There are fewer of them. There's only one game here that is dedicated to the Kinect amongst their launch titles, as opposed to when the 360 launched, or when the Kinect launched for the 360. There were a number of them, like 3 or 4. So it seems like they're reacting to the fact that even though it's a terrific piece of equipment, not a lot of people play Kinect dedicated games.
Yeah. Well, there's also the problem that like developers don't want to segment themselves that much. It's the same problem that like the Wii had. Like, there were some pretty good games that utilize the Wii motion sensor that Nintendo made, but like most game developers just didn't want to have to figure out an entirely new concept, that would only work on the Wii. And I would imagine that there's probably a similar issue when it comes to the Kinect, that even though it's really good, it's just going to take a while for developers and studios to figure out how to use it in a way that, doesn't, make them sort of stuck in the Microsoft garden.
Yeah, I mean, I see a lot of companies will integrate bits and pieces of their game, but not the entire game itself. And that's probably and to tell you the truth, that's probably a smart move for at least this crowd, because you're more looking at the hardcore gamers for E3 and for these type of large announcements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some of the other games that are launching for the Xbox One: Forza 5, For the Xbox One, the racing game features a Drivatar system that learns your race style and then races on your behalf against online opponents while you're away from the game.
What?
Yes. So you know, it learns your racing style, and then while you're off the system, when you're not racing, your Drivatar, your basic car and account will go out amongst the cloud and race on your behalf against other online opponents. And then when you come back, it will have learned new things. I think it'll learn new elements of driving. I'm not entirely sure how it works, but it's essentially your Drivatar continues to evolve while you're away from the game.
That is fascinating. I can't tell if that's brilliant or just crazy. We'll make a robot that plays the game for you.
Essentially, an AI.
Oh, you don't have to.
It's an AI that does it. You know, that does it while you're away.
I need to outsource my video game playing.
That somehow seems to take away the whole point of playing video games, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
But now you can always play against your friends.
That's true. Well, against my friends' Drivatars. We're having so much fun together.
I wish I could have that much fun. Project Spark. The Xbox 360 has always lacked a competitor to Sony's Little Big Planet, but the Xbox One just got its own sandbox creation game, Project Spark. The game maker uses Kinect voice commands in conjunction with smart glass integration to sculpt levels intuitively. So, you know, I actually attended E3 this week, and there were a few games on my list that I needed to check out, and Project Spark was one of them after seeing the press announcement. So essentially, Project Spark is like it's a sandbox game where you create a world, you build the geography of the world, sort of like The Sims, or like I want to say, if anyone remembers that Lionhead Studios title Black and White from back in the day.
Oh yeah, it was such an awesome game. Or, well, it wasn't that great, but it was an awesome idea.
Or there was another one recently from another studio called From Dust. You remember that one?
Yep.
So it's kind of like that, where you build the terrain up, and then you populate the terrain with props, with enemies, avatars, objects, and you can imbue those objects with an intelligence. The enemies and the avatars, you can imbue them with an intelligence based on you basically program it. You program the intelligence by saying, you know, when you come near this object, it's going to react to you this way, and it can be an enemy. You can also there's a sort of a community element as well, where you can there are these library of intelligences that you can draw from that are created by user generated by the crowd, essentially, and you can apply those intelligences and gameplay styles and maps in your own usage of the game in your own account. So you build the environment, you populate it, and then you play within it according to the rules based on what you've created. So it's really interesting. It's very sort of open world and very customizable.
Yeah, it looked like a fun thing to play around with. I wonder if it gives you the ability to add your friends into it. If they can make it that sort of multiplayer or cooperative style, that could add to its existing value.
Sounds a little bit like Minecraft. Like, maybe not in execution, but in premise.
Right, sort of like Minecraft in when you're in the level building aspect, but then there's also the sort of playable aspect, which is a bit different from Minecraft because it allows you to really get in and customize how how you play the game. You can even modify the game so that it's completely different, sort of like the guy who demonstrated the game for me showed me how they use the game in sort of a top down 2D view and made it like a Asteroids type of game. Or like one of those you know, those bullet shooters. And this was using the sort of the same sort of elements, but in a different way.
Okay. I think the game which I found the most interesting was probably the Son of Rome, the ride game.
Son of Rome.
Uh-huh. It just seemed like it had elements of God of War and the push button action, but it just seemed like it had that epic feeling that you want from a next generation game, where you are, for at least the scene they showed, you were coming off of a boat and you were trying to basically storm a fortress, and you were watching, you know, the hectic portions of war all around you. So that seemed pretty unique. And yeah, of course, you know, they've got the typical Metal Gear Solid and Halo, but other than that, I guess there wasn't that much there that impressed me that was only available that was exclusive to Xbox. And generally speaking, I know we'll talk about Sony in a second, but generally speaking, I don't think there are that many exclusive titles. I think companies are definitely learning that, you know, if I can put in the developer time to build it for another major system, I'll get more money that way. So I think I didn't see as many, must-haves like you used to in the past.
That's a good point, Tosin. I wonder if that's because like it's just getting so expensive to build these games, or if just the power has shifted so that, you know, the studios that make the game are more powerful than the, the systems themselves. Which I think might be the case. I mean, like, honestly, like, now we talk about, you know, Rockstar and Ubisoft and EA and their various things. And, like, I can't remember from previous generations any, you know, other than Rare with the N64, like, caring about what studio made it.
Naughty Dog, of course, has...
Square.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess there were some. I might be misremembering.
There were a few, but not to the extent that there are now in terms of, you know, people just being able to put their build on whatever system they want and not be locked in.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, I think in part it's because of developers seem to have a power shift over consoles. And console manufacturers, but I think for the most part, it's because this new generation of consoles are there's a parity in the hardware between them, so that they're both essentially, and we'll get to it in a minute. I mean, they're essentially the same sort of architecture with very minor differences, but you can program for both of the systems more or less, you know, with parity between them. Not that you could play the same games on each system, because there are, you know, internal built-in restrictions. Then it's not completely, you know, it's not universal. But they're pretty much built the same. They're not built like the previous generation. Like the PS4 had that unique core architecture, and the 360 was close to sort of PC, desktop PC style of architecture, but not quite. But now they're both sort of aligned so that they're more or less like souped up PC desktop systems.
Yeah. Well, because souped up PC desktop systems are now have processors that are more like the core, and, you know, I mean, it's not uncommon to have dual and quad core PCs today. Sort of all collapses into one.
Yeah, but
I don't know, what do you guys think, sort of overall, like your gut feeling, like what is your guys' gut feeling on this? I've heard some sort of very heated conversations on the train commuting into work and whatnot from various other gamers about, you know, where they're going to go, what their loyalty is going to lie this generation.
Well, it's almost impossible to talk about this without talking about the Sony's announcement in comparison, because really a lot of the decision was predicated by what Sony was going to say at their press conference. Why don't we talk a little bit about that first, and then we'll talk about sort of the comparison between the two.
Sure.
So the PlayStation 4 was originally announced at an event back in February, and what we didn't know was they showed us the controller and some of the features, but they didn't show us anything about the system itself. At the E3 press conference on Monday, the PS4 finally showed its face and its price, which is $399, which undercuts the Xbox One by $100. The design style, it's basically a black box, which is similar to the Xbox One, and really, really similar to the PlayStation 2. If anything, it's attractive. But it's boxy.
Mm-hmm. It is smaller though.
Yeah, it's smaller, but it has a very similar sort of design sense to the PlayStation 2. The Xbox One was already generating controversy because of its somewhat onerous digital rights management policies. In that the Microsoft, the Xbox One requires daily internet connections and account verification, even for single player games. Basically, you had to check in at least once every 24 hours, even for single player games. Otherwise, you couldn't play the games.
Wait. You had to, what if you just didn't want to play for a day?
If you didn't want to play for a day and you came back to it without it being connected, it won't let you play. It's not going to let you play. You have to connect online at least within a 24-hour period. Once within 24-hour period, even if you want to play single-player games, not connected. Not...
You know what's one reason why I think that they're getting this pushback, and I'm not saying that this is right. I'm just noting it because they're still selling these games in a buy format. There's still this perception of, hey, I own this game. You know, like, no one questions the fact that I can't, like, I don't know, like my iPhone game or whatever. Like, well, I guess there's not really that sort of DRM. I guess I'm thinking more of the resellability
of these games. Yeah, which is a aspect as well, too. There is some resellability that also comes into play, too, with the Xbox One in terms of you no longer have that ability to resell the game on your own. There are some restrictions in how you can and if you can resell it or if you can loan it to friends. So that's also part of
it. Yeah.
Did you guys see the link I just posted?
I did. I'm looking at that right now, and I'm trying to sort of make sense at it.
Yeah, I skimmed some of it so far. I haven't gotten a chance to completely read it because I just got it. But supposedly, it's in a Microsoft engineer, and supposedly it's discussing why they made certain decisions about going certain routes in terms of their DRM and whatnot. After my quick glance, I sort of feel like these are just excuses. For me, it's like, okay, well, if you want a digital model, then go digital. Like, don't have...
Yeah, just say you have a digital model.
Just go digital. I mean, you know, I don't think you have to maintain with discs. And then also the whole thing about, like, it being a long-tail strategy this whole thing about the cost of games and, hey, you guys don't actually like using GameStop, so stop using them, blah, 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 blah.
Because of course everyone hates GameStop. Money.
It's all about the money here.
It seems to be, it's a very candid sort of rant about how, I mean, essentially how Microsoft, basically, it's a issue of mismanaging the message. But also, you're right. I think there's he's talking about making certain decisions that they feel that they had to make, and how it kind of screwed their advantage.
Yeah.
You see a classic example here of like Microsoft has the lead, and they have, you know, they want to squeeze as much as they can out of the lead. And so they, you know, are willing to sort of bet that, you know, their sort of momentum will take them through the next console generation. Whereas Sony realizes they definitely don't have the lead, and they have to be really aggressive in terms of pricing, in terms of features, in terms of everything else, so that, you know, they can take some of that back. And it's, you know, everyone did exactly what you'd expect them to do. You know, based on their positions in the market, except Nintendo, who just is sort of crazy.
I think they've given up. Either they've given up or they don't care.
Well, they're swimming in their like,
wow, that last
giant
line
Scrooge
in there.
McDuck
I just came to the bottom.
I mean, Nintendo has the same problem.
Oh, the line of the pastebin thing.
It says, honestly, if you care about anything other than pure games at all, Xbox One greater than PS4. If all you do is play games and nothing else, PS4. Which is very interesting, because I could totally see someone like using that as like billboard material.
As billboard material against Microsoft, like to PlayStation's advantage. That was PlayStation's sort of stance on this whole issue, in response to Microsoft's press announcement. They said, you know, we want to be about the games. They said we want to be about first and foremost about the games. I think their idea is they want to fold in the other stuff later, but at the very least, what their strong suit right out the gate is the games.
Right. And yeah, you don't you can move to digital downloads without having to change your pricing model immediately, right? You don't have to, or without having to change like this check-in model and all this other stuff. I know that Steam does it, of course, but do you have to be like Steam? And I understand the long-term goals for them, but it's usually like when you make changes, you have benefits to the users. And if you look at this, just looking at it from like a user perspective, what is the benefit that I, as a person, am getting? If all you're going to say is you're not going to have to deal with scratched discs, but you're going to pay more for it, I don't think that completely rides here, because A, you still need the disc, and you're also paying for it, right? So,
I think it's a shame that that this has happened, because I really do admire some of the technological advancements that Microsoft has made with the Xbox One, and I'm talking about not just the Kinect, which is incredibly complex. I mean, I saw a demonstration of that at E3, and it is working on another level entirely of constant sort of data collection in ways that I can't even imagine a game taking full advantage of. But also the whole smart glass thing. And I feel like they kind of shot themselves in the foot with their stance on DRM and always online and, you know, no discs. And I think maybe if they were to back off that a little and make it a little bit more open in the sense that the PlayStation 4 is now, that the addition of the state-of-the-art technology that they've already got going with them would push them over the edge and put them in number one spot.
Prior to any announcement, like before Xbox said anything or PlayStation said anything about new console, probably the top console, which I would have gotten first if I were to get a new console, would have been the Xbox console. Because I just have a lot of friends who, you know, I have friends on both consoles, but live at the time is so much better than PlayStation Online in terms of interacting, and that's where I would play games with friends at times.
Yep.
You know, very rarely on my PlayStation, if at all. And yeah, but I think that is diminished by some of the other attributes that, you know, as maybe as I'm older, I really do care about these changes. You know, it's not like I couldn't deal with always on DRM, with, you know, checking in once 24 hours. I think my service is decent enough, apart from like if I move, or it's not that I couldn't deal with the loading situation because I don't really loan, or but like, or, it's just things in the way which you can see are definitely more monetary opportunities and not in the best interest
of the user, of the consumer.
Yeah.
I agree.
Actually, the first thing which I thought of when they announced some of that stuff is I was like, oh, I know how Dwayne wants us to consider getting both consoles, but I was like, the first thing I was like, oh, well, I'll get an Xbox and when it comes out, and I'll play it with friends. I'll take it to the office so we can try it there. And then I started thinking, oh, wait a second, because I need to at least make sure I'm checked in at some point. Because I have to think about where you now have to think about where you need to put your console, right?
Right.
Because if I was going to bring it to the office, I'd have to now, rather than just put it next to any old place, I need to also think about having an internet connection if I haven't plugged it in previously at home, like that sort of stuff, which is like, really? Do I need to actually like go through that hassle just to play a game with some local friends?
Yep.
I guess this is where the lack of differentiation between the system and the titles becomes really bad for Microsoft, because if there's no differentiation and the primary differentiations are, well, one is more expensive and has more, you know, DRM, and the other one is cheaper and I don't have to worry about internet connections and everything, it seems like it makes it a relatively clear choice.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is sort of the sentiment of a lot of people evaluating both systems while they were watching the press announcements this week. Is they said, well, you know, pretty much Sony won this fight handily. You know, they without much of a fight at all, because they came in $100 less than Xbox. It had already been sort of reported that the hardware in the Sony was marginally faster and more powerful than the Xbox One as it is. So you would add that to the $100 cheaper price, plus the fact that there's no used game block. It doesn't have to be always on. Region free. When it comes to discs, you can trade your discs and sell your discs. What you can do, sharing discs, which Sony, you know, they pretty much skewered the Xbox with this video demonstrating how to share games on the PS4. I don't know if you've seen this video. It's our viral video of the week. We're gonna have it in our show notes. But essentially, it's like an official Sony DIY demonstration. There's a title on the screen that says "How to Share with the Games on the PS4," and it's sort of, you build up this title, and then you cut to a scene between two people, and one of them has a disc in his hand. He turns to the other one and says, "Here you go," and the other guy says, "Thank you." And that's it. It was a real sort of slap in the face, directly pointed at Microsoft, and I think it was delicious. So yeah, I mean, essentially, the it seems like the mind of gamers have already been made up with in this battle between the two of them.
Do you think it's too clear of a win? I mean, Microsoft could always change the pricing.
Well, see, here's the other thing. Before we talk about that, one of the arguments is the devil's advocate argument is that the whole DRM thing that Microsoft is being criticized for is a decision made by the publishers, the publishers, and not by the system itself. And in fact, Sony says that they'll leave it to third-party publishers to set their own rules on used titles as well. So it may be, it may not be, like, the, Sony and Microsoft may have the same restrictions when all is said and done, based on whatever the third-party publishers are going to dictate. However, who's going to be the third-party publisher who sets a restriction on their title on the PS4 after this whole, you know, after this this big, highly publicized, you know, battle between the two of them, with Sony coming out on top because of their lack of DRM?
Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the other interesting things about the consoles that was also announced was Sony is allowing indie developers to basically self-publish to their platform,
right,
which is really excellent play, because a lot of publishers have voiced their, at least a lot of the indie publishers have voiced their displeasure with Xbox Live and trying to get their games up there, as well as update their games through Xbox Live. It's a very difficult and rigorous process. Now, I know Microsoft is now saying that they are for indie developers and planning to make some changes, but Sony was the outspoken one and actually had, I believe it was 4 or 6 developers on stage. This is actually the first E3 that I've watched all press conferences all the way through, because I really wanted to see what they had to say and how they would compare with each other. And there were some other interesting titles that I saw, and these were primarily, you know, titles that were not exclusive to one console or the other. For example, The Division and a few other things. But I just think it's Sony definitely was just on the offensive, and which is really interesting for a Japanese company, because you've never seen this side of Sony before, and they were just taking it to Microsoft, which is a lot of fun to watch. Now, in terms of what's actually going to happen with the how it's all going to shake out, it's really hard for me to tell, because, you know, I think as gamers, as, you know, techie people, we're really close to it all. We're really, you know, in the gulf, deep into the ditches on the front lines. And so we see reaction, and we have our own reaction, which I think, generally speaking, is that, you know, hey, the DRM, these loaning policies don't add anything positive for us gamers,
right?
And we will not spend our money in that facility. But what about the average mom and dad, you know, kid who already has 360, already has been using Live to play with friends? You know, how much will this actually have how much will this actually deter people from purchasing it? Will it just be something that that everyone shakes their fists at, but still provides a fistful of money for it? Or will it actually change the buying patterns and potential? It's hard to say. It's really hard to say. Yeah. I think, and also just another point in terms of what I think is really polarizing for us geeky folks, or nerds, if you wish. I took a quick poll this late afternoon. Uh-huh. This late afternoon, and sent a quick poll to a work gaming group, which I know is full of a lot of PC gamers. And I, at the last time I checked, I had, I believe it was like 40 replies. And this is a poll of, you know, what console would I, if I'm to get a console, you know, within the next 8 months, would I purchase an Xbox One, a PlayStation 4, a Wii U, 2 consoles, or none? What was actually winning out was none. that was winning at like a 50% rate. But second to that was PlayStation 4. And I believe the Wii may have been beating the Xbox by like one vote. The Wii U.
Ooh, ouch. Wow.
So you can see how people, you know, on the front lines are reacting. The question is, how far will that perpetuate?
I don't think the Wii U is actually going to do that well. The Wii U is just such a collection of hubris and more hubris.
Yeah, that was like two votes to like one, so it was very minimal. And, you know, this was an informal, quick poll through, you know, Google Utilities. But, yeah.
I have to admit, the Xbox, the PS4 is definitely the one that I'm leaning towards. I mean, I'm not much of a gamer, but it's nice to have, you know, the device around. But I don't know, just I don't see any reason to get the Xbox at this point. And I'm actually glad that I ended up not getting the Xbox this generation, so I don't feel locked in.
I think we're going to know realistically when it gets closer to holiday season. I think, you know what I think is going to determine it? Not the hard facts, but the marketing. I think between now and then, it's going to be Microsoft's game to lose through the marketing. And they're going to be, I think they're going to market on their strong suit, which is their games more than anything else.
Yeah.
Whether that's right or not, I mean, I personally am swayed for the PS4. And as that, I'm sort of inured to whatever marketing is going to be coming my way from Microsoft. But I think that's going to make the difference.
Yeah, I actually, you know, what I think is also going to be huge is who releases first, too. So by that, I mean, if the PlayStation 4 releases before the Xbox One, that's going to be huge in terms of, you know, you'll already have set the bar with this performance, this low price, and then the second console that comes out for parents during the holidays costs $100 more. Which way will they lean? I think that would be huge if they can come out first and beat the Xbox One or X-Bone, as a lot of people have been calling it now.
X-Bone, yeah.
Well, the price difference alone is going to be a huge, huge, huge thing. Like, in terms of what's going to actually drive sales. I mean, as much as the market, especially when you're talking about parents who, like, let's face it, aren't paying attention to the marketing.
Right. Right. Absolutely. I mean, seriously, that is a major factor. And I think it's a factor that, like, gets overlooked or underestimated quite a bit, is the fact that parents are the ones whose wallets are going to open and be shelling out the money for this.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about some of the other features of the PS4 that were announced at the press announcement. So their PS4, you know, Microsoft touted their sort of video services during their press announcement as one of their strong suits. But Sony also mentioned their own content services. Services like Video Unlimited, Redbox, and Flixster are some of the services they're going to be launching on the PlayStation Network. And they'll be available on the PS3 as well. Speaking of, the PS4 is going to support the same PlayStation Plus service as the Vita and PS3 with no new subscription price increase. It's all folded together, which is about $50 a year.
Hmm.
Unlike the PS3, however, a Plus subscription will be required for online multiplayer games. Thankfully, you won't be required to have Plus to access the media services such as Netflix and the like.
It's amazing. That was the one thing that I really love there, because, of course, right now, to do it on a 360, you need the additional Gold membership to even just play Netflix. You have to subscribe to another service just so you can use the service you subscribe to.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And that fact alone has compelled me to want to join PlayStation Plus, as it is, because I have a PS3 right now and I'm not a Plus subscriber. But just the fact that it's already going to be ready and set and ready for me when and if I get the PS4 is a very compelling proposition. We talked before about Gaikai Cloud Technology, which Sony acquired last year, as a possible way of playing games before buying using a streaming game technology. Well, they announced that that the Gaikai technology will be used to power the PS4 spectating experiences, which is the first time a home game console has entered this territory, although PC gamers have enjoyed those services for a long time with the OnLive service. Mm-hmm. Sony has so far, what about PS3 games playing on the PS4? Well, Sony has so far discussed PS3 gameplay on the PS4 under the same umbrella as playing PS1 and PS2 games via a digital library in a yet-to-be-determined PlayStation cloud service. So I think they're planning on using that same Gaikai streaming technology for that, in the same way that PC users have used on the OnLive service. Mm-hmm. Sony also demonstrated games at E3, as you'd expect, and a mix of new games and sequels such as The Order, Killzone, Shadowfall, Infamous Second Son, and Quantic Dream's tech demo, The Dark Sorcerer. Some hard facts about the PS4 hardware. It has an 8-core x86 AMD Jaguar CPU, 1.84 teraflop AMD Radeon graphics, 8 gigs of GDDR5 memory, 500 gig hard drive, Blu-ray drive, 3 USB 3 ports, 802.11 BG and N Wi-Fi, Ethernet HDMI Bluetooth 2.1, 500 gig hard drive for storage, 3 USB 3 ports. So I mentioned that already. So there we go. I have to say that the PS4 booth was the first booth that I went to at E3 this week. And I did actually check out the Quantic Dreams The Last Sorcerer tech demo, which was a 15-minute, essentially short movie that was running in real time on the PS4, and it looked phenomenal. It looked like, you know, state-of-the-art rendered CGI graphics. And the person who ran the demo showed us how they could zoom in and zoom out so we could see all of the textured detail of the characters and the props, the hair moving back and forth, the feathers, individual feather hairs on the character's feather-laced sort of jacket. And then he switched over to a wireframe view to show us that it actually is running in real time, and we could see the wireframe details. And he said that using that tech demo uses half of the full power of the PS4. So fairly impressive. And I have to say that it just looks like it's just going to be just, you know, that they can only go from up from here with the PS4 as far as where they're starting from. With the awesome power involved in this, it's making me really want the PS4 right now.
Well, you can pre-order it on Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think another big thing for E3, of course, is also the multi-platform games. And I think a lot of those were pretty rich and kind of fun to see.
Uh-huh.
See what direction they're going with in a lot of the various systems. There are some teasers out there too. There was a teaser for a new Star Wars game.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to remember what. Do you recall seeing that teaser?
Did not. I did see the one that you showed me, The Division, which we'll talk about in a second. But I didn't see the Star Wars one.
It was for Battlefront. It wasn't really much of a trailer. It was literally 35 seconds, but it was pretty awesome knowing that, hey, there may be another Star Wars game around the bend. But yes, let's talk about The Division because, oh man, that looked amazing.
So this is from Ubisoft, and it is it's Tom Clancy's The Division. So it's essentially a Tom Clancy part of the Tom Clancy franchise, and like the upshot of this game is it takes place in New York City, and specifically the part of the gameplay that you showed me in the clip that you sent to me takes place in Dumbo, the down under the Manhattan Bridge underpass and overpass, and it takes place in a sort of a post, I don't want to say post apocalypse, but after a viral infection. And by the way, viral infections seem to be the zombie, sort of the zombie apocalypse of today. Like, it's viral infections now, both with The Division and The Last of Us and a couple of other games all involve viral infections. So there's a viral infection that sweeps New York City and the whole, basically the whole region. And it's a sort of group gameplay where you and your fellow multiplayers are going in and sort of locking down the streets. You know, there's sort of rioting and unrest, and society has gone amok. And so you go from region to region, locking down the streets. I'm doing a terrible job at describing this, Tosin. Why don't you tell me?
No. It's I guess the core elements to that game is it's cooperative. Yeah. So you are exploring with other friends that you have online. Your friends who are offline can actually also hop into the game. There was a scene in part of the game where a drone came overhead, and that was another friend who hopped into the game for a little bit and helped, you know, point out different enemies as well as target them too. And the key component is it's really like the world is in chaos. You are now working as a team to I'm actually not sure what the end goal your team has in particular, mm-hmm. but you're at least working to survive and get all the things you need, such as like rations, weaponry. Uh-huh. But the way the world works is there are also other teams and other pockets of people, yeah. real life people yeah. that you will interact with. So you may like come around the bend and start, and they showed this like firefight between two groups of live. Two groups of actual people, so not AI. Uh-huh. And it's just like it's a whole. At the end of the video, they zoomed out and showed the whole world where like yeah. things are just changing based off of everyone playing together with either with other people or against other teams. It's just it seemed like it could be a lot of fun.
It almost seems like a massive MMFPS.
Yes. And, yeah. and I might let me just add here that both in The Division and Watch Dogs, which is another Ubisoft development, that both these games utilize. And you were mentioning it about the helicopter drone coming in. Watch Dogs uses this too. They use a separate player using some sort of smart glass sort of technology, a tablet. They're using a tablet. To access part of the game with the tablet and jump in and help players out using their own sort of overlay of the game. It's not a duplicate of what the users are seeing, what the regular players are seeing. It's a different mm-hmm. sort of interface. In the case of The Division, you have control over this helicopter drone and you can pop in and help these other players out, and you've got your own you're following your own sort of adventure using this tablet, this outboard tablet access.
And just to be clear, it's actually third person perspective. So it's like over the shoulder, mm-hmm. slightly back behind the individual. And it's just, it has lots of really cool features. There's this time they're pulling up a map of the city, and it's just kind of like 3D overlay that you're actually standing on top of while it's being projected on the ground. Just visually, it seems like it could be really cool.
They had that in Diablo. No, I know a bunch of people who are really, even people who are not traditionally into the sort of fighter shooter type games, like several of my friends' girlfriends are just really excited about it, which is, I think, pretty exciting because, you know, I don't know, I feel like that sort of genre is sort of very stuck with the people who like it and other people. You know, if you haven't been keeping up and are not on top of the FPS world, you kind of just ignore all those games because you know that you just are never going to be able to keep up. You're never going to be able to sort of really enjoy it. So it's kind of cool to see something shake that up a little bit and, you know, bring some new blood, some new people, some new ideas to it.
Yeah, and I think it seems like there's some sort of story, evolving story involved, because in that video clip, which definitely check it out, there was a point where they were actually looking at a map with several points highlighted, lots of information that you were digesting as a character.
I think the overall, I've heard this on another podcast on Revision 3, is that the overall story in The Division is that you, I think once you sort of lock down the different regions and help quell the unrest, you go on to learn a little bit more about this virus and find out who has been releasing it. And then I think you ultimately, like, that's your boss is that whoever it is that is unleashing this virus into the populace.
Hmm.
Let's talk about some of the other games that were announced or shown during this year's E3. Were there any others that you guys saw that sort of sparked your interest?
Yeah, there were a bunch of good stuff. Let's talk about sports really quickly.
Sure.
For the I haven't played a sports game in who knows how long, but for the basketball game, it's interesting the change in technology. So one of the things that they talked about for the NBA Live 14 segment is that in the past, the ball was just a portion of the character's hand. So you never have the ability to do tricky things or even really lose the ball. It was kind of stuck to the hand, and now it's its own object. So it's kind of getting, we're hitting that more realistic in terms of how you play the game. Similarly with like their soccer games with FIFA, the way the AI moves around and the way that you it just looks very clean and very it's very interesting to see how sports games are still managing to up the ante each year, even though they release on, you know, a very regular standard basis.
Yep, they always find a way to just add a little bit more realism. And something, it's usually something that you had never considered. Like, it was always good enough the year before, but then there's that one little extra bit of something that it was like, oh yeah, I guess we didn't have that bit of realism before.
Did you see the Battlefield 4 playthrough?
I did not. I did see, well, talk about Battlefield 4 and then I'll talk about Call of Duty Ghosts.
Oh, well, very quickly for the Battlefield 4, play, it was pretty remarkable in terms of the damage that you could do structurally. So for example, there was this portion where a tank was coming and they destroyed some pillars in this underground, sort of area or bunker that they were in, and that collapsed the road, which sunk the tank into the road, which was really awesome. And then there was also a point where a building was where they had to basically parachute off a building or paraglide off a building, but prior to it being completely destroyed, and you could, from the distance, you watch the building as it crumbled down. Like a huge tower or a huge skyline in a building. So
that was in Battlefield 4?
Or I mean, maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe was that Call of Duty?
Because I did see something like that in Call of Duty Ghosts.
I could be mistaken.
you're inside the building and it starts to collapse, and then it's your point of view as you see the building start to fall towards the earth. So maybe that is also in Battlefield 4, or you're conflating the two. It's so confusing because they're so, you know, it's like the both of those franchises get conflated in my mind anyway. But the Call of Duty Ghosts, I saw Call of Duty Ghosts video at E3 that was just amazing. It was one of the highlights of the show for me, and I think it was just in the presentation, because it before you saw any gameplay at all, it was prefaced with this sort of 5 minute, 5 or 6 minute sequence that set up the backstory to the world that Call of Duty Ghosts takes place in. And it's essentially, there's this satellite that's circling the Earth, and it's weaponized. It contains these rods, these metal rods that it fires at the Earth at high velocity. And when you're shooting something at such a high velocity towards the Earth, it doesn't take much. You don't need explosives. The velocity of the impact of something hitting the Earth at such a high velocity is itself devastating. And so there's a sequence of these rods reaching the Earth, and you don't actually see it. You see it in the form of descriptive graphics and like OS, like off-screen voices at some sort of control facility where they're trying to some sort of defense facility where they're trying to defend against these rods hitting the Earth. And then one by one, they hit all these regions of the U.S. And then it cuts to 10 years later, and that's where the gameplay of Call of Duty Ghosts takes place in. And then you see some of the great imagery, some of the imagery that they showed before in the previous Microsoft announcement, plus more imagery, but stretched across a huge screen, a like 180 degree screen in this display at E3. It was just amazing. Also, a couple of the other games that I saw at E3 that I found to be really interesting was the one of the most impressive things that I saw at E3, believe it or not, was a game that comes out today as we're recording. Actually, will come out as we release on Friday, The Last of Us, which is already getting great reviews. But I played about 15, 20 minutes of that game, and it is phenomenal. It is really impressive.
Now, is that another Naughty Dog property?
That is the Naughty Dog, the same guys that did the Uncharted series.
Yeah, they release amazing games. It's wow.
Yeah, so be sure to try that out. Another one was Beyond Two Souls, which is, I think, is also going to be for the PS3, I believe. I don't think that's going to be a PS4 release. And that is from Quantic Dream, the guys who did Heavy Rain, and who did that Last Sorcerer tech demo that they showed for the PS4. But that's the one that features Ellen Page and Willem Dafoe, and they're playing their characters pretty much look like the actors themselves. And Ellen Page has these special sort of properties, and she's has the ability to control this this other being inside of her called Aiden. And Aiden can stretch its sort of soul out and take over someone else's body and make that person do whatever she wants it to do. And that movie just looks beautiful. I mean, to boil down sort of the essence of that movie, it's a very sort of elaborate set of QuickTime events. And it's kind of on rails, but it,
like,
Yeah, but I'm because you almost can't go wrong because it's sort of the game sort of is on rails and it sort of self-corrects. But disregarding that, it's still a beautiful game to look at, and I think worth the gameplay ultimately. Those are a couple of games that I saw. I'm trying to think of what else here that I saw that was really interesting. Watch Dogs, I saw a 15-minute gameplay of Watch Dogs, which is essentially the same gameplay that they showed during the PS4 presentation. Still very interesting to watch. Anything else from either of you guys that you saw that was interesting?
I think that the one that was most exciting to me was the Tom Clancy one. Definitely.
Destiny. Did you guys see that one? That was the new MMO from Bungie.
Yeah, that looked interesting. Reminded me, of course, of Halo in certain aspects, but being able to play cooperatively. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of good stuff in there. Batman, a new Arkham Batman. Assassin's Creed could be interesting. I know there are a lot of people who are diehard about Kingdom Hearts 3. I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. I think the gaming industry still has a lot going for it.
Yep.
But once again, these are non-console exclusives, so pick up whichever one you want and game on.
And I'm really thankful for that too. I'm thankful that there's so much parity between the hardware of these two consoles now, because it just makes. I mean, I think that way. I mean, because the thing that really killed me about the last console generation, I think, were the exclusives. Were the fact that I couldn't play, you know, something like a Halo 3 on my PS4, or some of the other.
Well, my guess is you're still not going to be able to play Halo.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think you're right, but I think Bungie's correcting that because Destiny is coming out for everything, which is a real sort of change of pace for Bungie, a change of direction for them.
Another thing we're itching to hear about as the weeks go by, get our hands on, to try these consoles, try these games, and see how it all evolves and shakes out.
Yep. I mean, I can already tell you. I've got to, at the very least, we talked about on the last episode, Dwayne brought it up. I don't know, I can't remember if he brought it up during the show or after the show, but he talked about getting these consoles and just testing them out and then taking them back to the store. And I'm very compelled to do that with the PS4 at the very least. I'd love to get one of those in my hot little hands and test
just
it out.
See what it is there.
Yeah, agreed.
By the way, I have to mention that I this week I also received my Ouya, which was the Tegra 3 processor based console that is sort of focusing on indie games. And I have not tried it out yet. That's why it's one of the things that I didn't want to mention during the What We're Playing With segment, because I haven't even cracked it open because I've been so busy with E3 that I haven't had a chance to. Next episode of the Drill Down, I'll have time to crack it out and I'll be able to report on it. All right, why don't we go around the room here, and I'll start with you, Chris. Tell us where we can find your work when you're not on the Drill Down.
Well, you can find most of my blogging at chrisbrenor.com and my tweets and various links and everything at chrisbrenor on Twitter. And then if you're interested in sort of the more startup side of things, I curate a list of events in Silicon Valley and a email newsletter of sort of startup related articles at startupdigest.com with Chris McCann, who is my co-curator.
Awesome. Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me on Twitter at toast4321, like the bread. And you can also find my random ramblings and movie commentary at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
Cool. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. That's my Tumblr. Also, Facebook and Twitter at MrBabyMan as well. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. And we really want to hear from you guys. We want to hear what you think of the show, if you have any ideas of what stuff we should be talking about in the future. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. And we've really been ramping up our guest posts on the Drill Down in the last few months, so check those out. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach a targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location when we will have our NSA whistleblower Prism discussion. That's going to be a really interesting discussion.
Bring your whistles.
I can already anticipate that's going to be a heated discussion, so I cannot wait for that. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.